What is up, network? Today's podcast is supported by Bose Aviation. With over 30 years of serving active noise-canceling headsets to pilots, Bose is known for performance, quality, and reliability. The A20 Aviation headset, with 30% greater noise reduction than conventional aviation headsets, is one of the lightest, most comfortable around-ear headsets on the market. The ProFlight Series 2 builds upon the advanced technology of the original and is the most lightweight, compact, and comfortable aviation headset Bose has ever produced. To see which headset is right for you, visit bose.com/aviation. Hello, network. It is I, Adam. I just wanted to apologize up front as for the audio quality of this particular podcast. The levels are a little different, so when we get into the actual interview, it might be a little bit louder than this is recorded right now. You won't hear any of the theme music. We're trying something a little different on this one, so it'll go right into it with my guest, Ross Francomont. I hope you enjoy. Fly safe. Today's podcast is very personal to me. Why personal, you ask? Well, my guest, Ross Francomont, is a retired YouTube pilot, and for a period early in my career, I was extremely interested in following the same career arc that Ross did. Now, don't go thinking that we have the same backgrounds. Other than that little coincidental anomaly of briefly sharing those same aspirations, Ross and I have very little in common, because he is about 5 dozen times smarter than I am, takes a mean picture, and has follow-through. By graduating the United States Air Force Academy in 1999 with a major in laser physics and a minor in math, Ross showed he was suited quite well for what his future held. The flying stuff was probably going to be the easy part for Ross as he went on to complete undergraduate pilot training at Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi and then off to fly the C-21 in Germany. After that tour, Ross moved on to fly the Dragon Lady for nearly 15 years, where he picked up the interesting hobby of photography, flew as an instructor in the T-38 as well as the U-2, and started his family. Ross now flies for a major American air carrier. He is making photography much more than a hobby and can share some pretty out-of-this-world stories about his time above flight level 600, pun intended. Head over to extremerossphotography.smugmug.com to see his keen eye in action. Here is the first part of our 2-part conversation between Ross and I. I hope you enjoy. Ross, welcome to the Pilot Network podcast. It's awesome to have you as a U2 enthusiast and fan, and almost could have been, should have been, would have been a pilot if they would have accepted me had I put my stuff in. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Adam. Thanks for having me. I'm doing awesome.
Okay. We're going to jump right in with the question. So in the introduction, one of the things, and you'd written this down, and I found this to be just hilarious. And I think I know what you're going to, I think you know what I'm going to ask. But so for those of you listening out there who can't see this, Ross wrote this down as his intro, and I want you to see his face. We did not prep any of this. So he said when he got to his first unit after USAF graduation in 1999, he initially worked as a porn hunter, a comm squadron, as a casual lieutenant. How in the hell did that job end up with your major in laser physics and minor in math? Are you a porn hunter?
I was actually at the academy, and they needed something to do with us until I started pilot training. So they put me in the comm squadron, and on the first day, they said, "Hey, we have this job for you." And at the time, this was '99. The network, you know, they didn't exactly block everyone, but it did. It would like flag things on their network if somebody went to a site they weren't supposed to. And they said, "We want you to look through our records of things that have been flagged, and we want you to see who's going to sites they shouldn't, but then you have to go verify that those are inappropriate sites, and then you're going to have to document this on some kind of Word document, and then we send it out to legal." So they literally just gave me access to the firewall, and it was, I would see, a cadet had gone to this site, and they went to it for like 2 seconds. I'm like, that's not a problem. I'm not going to bust their balls for something like, tripping up on a site or whatever, going somewhere. It was my discretion, basically, who was going to get in trouble. But I will tell you that doing a job like that really makes you lose faith in humanity, because there's a lot of people going to some really messed up stuff out there.
Really?
And, yeah. And so one of the worst, and I don't know the name or anything like that, but hopefully it's not listening now, but there was actually a captain at the time, an Air Force captain, who was a math teacher. And I could go in there. I saw that this guy every single day after school from like 4:30 to 5 was going on to a site called buttfetish.com. And don't go Google that. I'm sure it's, you know, this is on Netscape or something, you know, like 20 years ago. So the it was,
somebody's already Googling it,
right? Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm probably just completely pinged their total for a couple of years now, but so I had to go to this site. I'm like okay, I have to verify. And so this site was literally a site with just ordinary average people sent in like Polaroids of their butt naked. And I mean, it was literally just pages of it. And it was one of those that I was just like, I'm like, oh my God, this is awful. Cause most people's butts are not anything.
Very, like that, you know? Yeah. Oh yeah.
So it, I was just like, this is awful. And this guy literally had been doing this for months. Like, so, you know, so this wasn't a, oops, I accidentally went to this site. It was, you know, I was able to see he had gone for like 30 minutes a day after school. Obviously after he had been teaching.
On .mil computers, man.
On his government computer in his, you know, teacher area or whatever.
And, oh my gosh.
Yeah. But, so that was literally my job for like a couple of months. But like I said, it really just made me lose faith in humanity. Like they're looking at some awful stuff.
I bet. I mean, and that probably wasn't even awful. That was just,
yeah, that was just more disturbing, you know.
Yeah, humorous. And wow, if that's what your fetish is, sure. We've all got our skeletons, but my goodness, on a .mil computer on top of it all.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's before that people really knew that, hey, that's your goofiness is best saved for at home.
Exactly.
And so they take this rock star in laser physics and math.
Yeah.
Send you off to pilot training where you get the C-21 at Ramstein. Life is amazing, which I know that there was a couple guys in my class who got C-21s. And I remember, fast forward before that, there was a guy right when I got to Vance who got the C-9 to Ramstein. Talk about the what we were all told the best deal in the Air Force that was going to go away. And one of the guys, instructors who, you know, not a FAPE type, who'd said, no, that's not true. There's one deal that's better. We're like, what's that? And he goes, the C-9 to Yokota. He goes, that's a better deal.
Go, oh. Yeah. Those were all up in the high category of deals. So, I mean, the C-21 was pretty awesome. I think one of the best deals was, there were a few people who got C-21s to Stuttgart. And it was like a geographically separated unit that they were completely off on their own. They had like four jets and they flew basically into like Bosnia every day and Tuzla and got tax-free every single month. So, but, and they had no oversight. They were literally part of our group and nobody even hardly knew they were there.
So. Oh, that's, you know, I guess we can all dream, you know, we can all dream, but as somebody who has been in the tanker his entire career, I mean, I've had my fair share of good deals, but nothing like that. I have a couple of friends who can take that and really run with it. Good deals as far as that goes. But let's back up even further than that. I wanted to ask, so one of the things that we try to ask any pilot or pilot type or just aviation nut is, where did you get that first real interest in aviation? What kind of turned you on to the whole thing?
You know, I think it really came for me the very first time I flew, which I was only 4 years old. And at the time my dad's parents, they got a job over in Kenya, and he was running a battery factory in Nairobi, Kenya. And they invited us out one summer, brought us out. And again, I was only four, and it was on a I'm flying on Eastern Airlines. It's from Charlotte to New York to get on a Pan Am flight. And that very first flight, I told my dad, and even he would tell me this all the time. He's like, "Yeah, you told me right then that I'm going to fly a plane. I want to do that. I want to sit up there and do this when I grow up." And so it really started there, you know. And I at that time, I didn't know anything like the Air Force or anything like that. I just knew I was going to fly.
Yeah.
I just had to fly.
So then I think, you know, a lot of us have those similar kind of one-off seminal moments, as they were, in our lives that we can point to where the hook was sunk, right?
Yeah.
And then how did that look as far as you you go through high school, whatever that stuff, and we won't get too deep into those details because there's so much that we want to cover. And I want to take a deeper dive into, okay, so as you talk in the introduction, we talk about kind of how you've gone all through this stuff and you become a YouTube pilot and then you get into photography and all that. How did one go from, okay, I go from flying the C-21 out of Ramstein, I do the apply interview, get accepted, become a YouTube guy. And we're going to get into all that stuff. This will bounce around a lot. And then, you know what, I'm going to start taking pictures and I'm going to make, and maybe I'm pretty good. I take some pretty badass pictures. How does that kind of sequence events go? Because I think there's a lot of us out there, some with the entrepreneurial bug, some who just want to go and dabble in the world of what do I do outside of piloting? Because and this is a sidebar to all this, a fellow, another friend of mine who flies for United, he had a very freak medical incident occur recently, and he's on the mend and everything is A-okay, but he's really concerned that his medical might be held up for a while, or I'm sure he'll get it back, but what if it happens again and he doesn't? So he's starting to take that step back and look, well, what else is there out there for me to cover that in case I can't do this anymore? Because it's one, we kind of all had the dream or the bug to do it. And then two, we got to stay almost like, and I don't want to compare us to pro athletes because nobody would ever mistake most of us for being a professional athlete. But I think the bigger thing is you never know when it's your last day to go. I mean, yeah, you never know when it's your last day and live life like it's your last, all that stuff. But you never know when you could be in a car accident and you might survive just fine.
Yeah.
But your medical may not.
And yeah, exactly.
So how does one go from all that educational wise and employment and all that stuff and adjust to start going, you know what, I like this photography thing too. And I want to start making all this work together.
You know, I mean, so something like that, I guess for me, it's just, I've always tried to keep as many doors open, like through the whole process. And, going all the way back to the academy, I wasn't pilot qualified at the time. I still have one bad eye. I have to wear one contact lens. But I thought my entire time going through the academy, I was not going to be a pilot. They told me that. Because I have one eye that's 2200. And they said, that's not, pilot qualification. So that was one reason I'm like, okay, I got to start looking to do something else. So I kept the doors open. I found out I like doing physics stuff. I like that. At that time, I didn't know anything about photography and wasn't even something really an option, but it was kind of the foundation of the photography was there. I liked dealing with light and stuff like that. Did laser physics and, studied the way light propagates and all that kind of stuff. It's all a bunch of nerdy stuff. I was a huge nerd, by the way. So if that's not clear, that's probably not the like woke term today. Nerd is probably like socially challenged. I was, one of those guys. But
Rossi, you're over the age of 40 and you use the term woke.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a big deal, dude.
I was like, okay, this stuff's interesting. So I'm going to pursue that. And then, I was fully ready. I was either going to be a navigator or I was going to work as a physicist in the Air Force. And in my last semester, that another door opened up that said, they basically said, hey, we need more pilots. The timing was good. And they basically said, are you correctable to 2020? Yes. Do you want to be a pilot? Okay. Yeah. You get a waiver. And I got a chief of staff waiver that, you know, along with a bunch of other people in my class. And, you know, it, you know, that then led down the road that I'm going now, but I still had that background that, you know, I was basically trying to keep, it wasn't like I was laser focused on being pilot. You know, it's not like I'm laser focused on being the world's best photographer and stuff today. I mean, I like what I do with the photography, but I, you know, for me, it's more of a process of creation. I think that just the process of creating something helps keep your mind a little bit open. It keeps you sharper, and it helps keep you open to some of these other opportunities that are going to come up that you never even possibly considered. You know, I went from photography. I've worked with pictures to working with video. I'd like to get into working with sound stuff as well. And, you know, editing pictures, things like that. So as long as I look for those opportunities and keep those doors open, I think, you know, you're going to put yourself in the best position that you can. If, you know, the worst happens and you're not going to be able to ever fly again, you at least have an idea of where you can go from there, you know, what other things are out there. But I think, you know, I mean, we all have, you know, all of us that are pilots all have that, you know, at least we all have the smarts to be able to be an entrepreneur. And I know with me, it's probably the biggest thing for me is it's kind of a laziness thing now. I could probably do more if I wanted to spend more time, but, you know, I want to spend time with my family. I'd rather, you know, not spend every waking moment on working on pictures and going and doing photography for people and stuff like that. But that is an option. I know I could definitely pick up the camera and go freelance if I had to go work some video editing. And I try to keep that network open as well. I've got friends who are in the movie business and stuff that I could, you know, if I had to, you know, call them up and probably, sorry, my phone was ringing.
No problem.
You know, I could probably call them up and at least have a direction of where I could go. So I think it's all about keeping those doors open.
And just to make sure everybody knows that you're self-taught, there was no formal photography. You weren't mentored by the, you know, a great photographer or something like that. At first this was kind of a self-experimentation, trial and error process.
Yeah, it was. And when I came in the U2, there were a few guys who had done photography from the U2. Some of them still are out there today, but, you know, they were the ones that kind of first, I think they took some of the initial photos I saw and I was like, wow, you know, compared to my little crappy Canon PowerShot, you know, $99 PowerShot camera. Of course, because we didn't have smartphones with cameras at the time. But I'm like, man, those pictures make that look like crap. They were the ones that kind of got me interested in at least exploring possibility. And I think I took that. And then each time I went up, like I said, self-taught, iterative process where I take a ton of photos. And anytime you're getting into something like, you know, photography, the only way you can really get better is just do it. And then you have to go back and look at your work. And then you have to self-critique yourself. Like one thing I found that was happening in a lot of my photos is I'm getting all these reflections off the glass. So then, you know, then it's a experimentation of like, okay, how do I reduce that or eliminate it? You know, because you can do some in post-processing, you can do some, you know, but there's a lot of things you can do in the moment to help reduce some of these reflections in the cockpit, you know, whether it's just the direction you're pointing the camera, you know, based on where the sun is and stuff like that. And so it was literally just a process of of doing that, figuring out what I did wrong. And those are very perishable skills. And I know I did a 3-year staff tour where I didn't, you know, take any pictures out of U2, and I came back with, I had forgotten almost every, all of those little details. So,
oh yeah. So it was a double learning process. You had to go back and learn it again.
It was, you know, at least there was a little bit of that. Oh yeah. I remember I had to do this, you know, and, you know, I think it kind of helped too that I kind of set out a goal, with my photography. Like I had, you know, I'd always been very interested in night photography and stuff like that. And, you know, it first started out, I was like, okay, I know how awesome the stars look from YouTube at night. So I would dim down the cockpit, basically black, you know, get good night vision. And, you know, you're above all the night, the light pollution, and you're, you know, just an incredible sight. And I'm like, I need to be able to capture this with a camera. And I tried it a lot of different ways. And that was the one thing I figured out, okay, you know, a lot of times in photography, it's not necessarily the camera, it's, you know, the person behind it, it's the composition. There's a lot of factors that go into it. Well, what makes a good picture, you know, or what makes a picture that someone wants to look at, you know, or something makes someone go, wow. That was one of those things where I realized, like, okay, I'm really up against the technological limitation, at least with the crappier cameras I had before.
Sure.
And that was one of those things that, you know, I just said, okay, I need to have a good camera that can capture a lot of light in a very short amount of time, you know, and make it look good. And it still involved a lot of post-processing stuff. And that was one of those things I realized too from an early point in photography is that literally half the game is after you've taken the picture. People that, you know, and I've even told people straight up there, like, wanted to get into photography. They're like, well, I don't want to spend a lot of time like editing photos and stuff. I'm like, if you ever want to take it beyond just, you know, taking some nice pictures for the family and stuff like that, you have to spend time in that editing, post-processing time.
Sure. So
like that is literally half of the game right there. And if you just take stuff in like JPEG format, and you know, when you do it, and you never go back, you never crop it for composition or any of that kind of stuff, then like you're always just going to have kind of mediocre, average photos. You're never going to be able to take that further.
There's something that I think you and I can tell all those folks out there. If you have a interest in something like starting your own podcast or taking a lot of great photos and making that into something where you could possibly make a couple extra bucks off of, or if you just want to show your art to the world.
Yeah.
You're going to start doing layovers to the same places over and over and over again. And
yeah.
Besides getting a good workout in and maybe having a decent meal, you don't always need to go out and drink with the guys and the gals.
Yeah.
In fact, most times you're going to probably stop doing that, and you're probably going to be more worried about getting a good night's sleep, especially if you got young kids or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a great opportunity to use the road as that place to go do some of that post-processing or editing. I am a horrendous when it comes to editing, because it takes so long to edit a podcast.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we do is we actually have an editor that we have worked with us, but some of the stuff, recording little things like if we're going to do some sort of advertisement or marketing, or if we want to do introductions, or Matt and I kind of set up a standard beginning and end to the podcast. You know, the music you hear in the beginning, the music you hear at the end. And in the beginning, you actually hear radio calls from, I believe it's LaGuardia and a couple other places mashed together. And that was just stuff where it was like, okay, I got some time on the road. So that's a great point. Hey, you're going to have to spend a little more time than just hitting the click on the shutter.
Yeah.
So you got to do a little bit more than that. So how does one, I understand motivation to be a photographer. I mean, I get it. Taking cool photos is cool. And there's not a lot of people who get to take them of the edge of space. So, or from the edge of space. So that's going to be, you're going to get probably pretty cool pictures, even if they're not done to the Nat's ass perfection that you'd like to have it done. But how does one go from, okay, you know what, I'm going to take some of these cool pictures and I can show my friends, to going, you know what, maybe I can take these and I can share them in a more dynamic or expansive way, possibly even turning it into some sort of hobby profession, as you will. I don't ever like to say career, because that would assume that you're basically trashing everything else. It's, I don't look at TPN as my career. I look at it as a hobby profession that, I really enjoy and would love to make, you know, a gargantuan sum of money on, but I'm not going to. I might make a little bit, but I get to, other people get to benefit from it, I hope. And I think that you probably feel similarly in that, hey, look at, I like looking at it, and I hope other people do too. So how does one get from the crappy Canon power shot to, you know, somebody who's going to actually buy this?
Well, you know, so for me, I mean, this took place over years, and, you know, I had started taking pictures of YouTube back, you know, when I first got in 2005, and, you know, and I had, you know, for me, it had been a process of just, I want to improve this art, because, I mean, and it really is, it's art. You're creating art, and you bring it back, and you deal with it on the computer. You know, trying to improve it. You know, I, you know, to up to 2018, you know, I'd basically just been working on improving, getting some of these shots. I thought I still want to get some of the night stuff. I was kind of working towards, like, I really want to get shots of the Northern Lights eventually. I knew that was going to be a challenge. I put on my Facebook page, I had I'd had all these pictures for years, mm-hmm. and I decided one day I'm just going to throw a bunch of the pictures together, because these are all kind of spread out over years on my Facebook page. I'm like, I'm just going to make one big, like, picture album of a bunch of YouTube photos.
Okay.
And so I shared it just on my normal page, which is a, you know, private page of friends. And there was another YouTube guy that was like, hey, we have the, you know, the Dragon Lady fan site. I'd like to be able to share your album on that. But it's, right now it's private. You'll be able to make it public. And that was kind of the fateful decision of mine that I kind of, once it happened, I ran with it. But I made that public, and within a day or so, this album had gone viral all over the internet. And the other guy, a guy from The Aviationist, David Cincinnati, he picked it up and published it on his site, which, you know, he has a couple hundred thousand people on there. So when this happened, and I really, like, people started writing me like, hey, how can I get a hold of your picture? I'd never really thought of trying to promote my pictures as something like mm-hmm. the public could look at or possibly buy. And, you know, right about this time, you know, I'm getting all these messages. This all happened in really close proximity when my dad very quickly passed away from cancer. And, you know, and I was still kind of feeling a lot of the, you know, the feelings from that, the remorse. And, you know, but I think part of it's, you know, when you see, you know, a parent pass away, and you're like, man, this life is, it's moving along, and, you know, I need to get moving along with it here. I'll never forget. I was doing yard work in my front yard, because that's what, you know, I do at home.
that's the actual career.
Yeah. So my wife may argue with that there's no sitting on the couch, but no, I was doing yard work, and, you know, and I was thinking, why should I not go forward with this as a business? And, you know, it was kind of all that kind of came together. And that was right about the time too, that I had the opportunity to fly a flight that did go through the Northern Lights. And I remember, like, on the day I was flying that flight, I had a guy from Business Insider calling the squadron, trying to get a hold of me as I'm going to get suited up in the, in the spacesuit. And so all this was kind of hitting, and I didn't want to tell, you know, I didn't have time to talk to him then, so I was literally stepping out of the squadron to go put on the spacesuit. And but I knew that, you know, I was hoping, I'm like, I'm going to go out and hopefully get some of the coolest pictures ever seen today, you know, tonight, going through the Northern Lights. And so all that kind of hit, and suddenly, you know, this thing, I got some awesome pictures, put a bunch of them together, put them online, put it in, and I made a little video too. I did, one of the things I started getting interested in was time-lapse photography, mm-hmm. you know, where you're basically taking photo over and over again. I had this, when I went out to do that flight in the Northern Lights, I put several days worth of preparation into just exactly what order I planned to take these photos. Because I already had I had a song in mind. I was going to make a video. I went out, and so I had this whole plan of attack. Ended up not going as well because I had a mount for the camera. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty big camera, and I broke the mount within the first hour of the flight. But you know, it's like, hey, well, you know, shit, I just completely ruined my chance. But then I figure out some different settings, and everything that I got was pretty much hand taken, not mounted. And including all the time lapse I ended up getting on the flight. Mm-hmm. But you know, I ended up putting that together, and then had some news agencies that wanted to pick it up. And again, I was working with at that time, the public affairs office at Yale was working with me. There was this big segment that got aired on the CBS News about my Northern Lights flight. Wow. This was like a national thing. And it was funny that the day that aired, when I woke up that day, I had no idea I was going to be on CBS News that night. It literally happened like during the day. I was literally going out to fly a two-ship formation flight in T-38. Right before I stepped, the public affairs officer of the base came in. He's like, hey, just let you know, CBS News wants to interview you. And I was like, when? I'm thinking like next week or 2 weeks from now.
Yeah.
And he's like about 2 hours from now. And he's like, they're putting it on today. He's like, it just has to be approved to the Pentagon.
Just a quick approval process at the Pentagon.
He was like, don't worry. He's like, if you probably won't get it because I'm sure it won't get approved in time. And the way it worked out, I won't get into all the details, everything that happened on the ground, but basically I ended up not doing the interview, even though it was approved. It was just some other things happened with some of the leadership. So,
sure.
So this thing then goes on the air, you know, it's 3:30 my time in California, when it's first aired on the East Coast, and suddenly my phone starts blowing up with text and people are like, holy shit, you're on the news. Like, I didn't know I was gonna be on the news today. you can actually, even when you Google it, you can Google like YouTube Northern Lights, like CBS News, and see the segment there. I really wish I would have been on the interview for it, because they made it kind of sound like I was just like flying along and suddenly these Northern Lights just happened and I just grabbed a camera and it was like, they were pretty much like, how in the world can you do this with a plane going so fast? And
yeah, that, well,
not to mention, you know, I was sitting there on the autopilot, you know, doing, you know, 400 true, you know, 0.7 Mach, and with a 12-hour flight, basically just sitting on my butt. So, it was crazy that, you know, all that publicity and stuff. And I'm like, well, shoot, I gotta
capitalize
on this business.
Yeah, there. Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
Yeah. And unfortunately the Air Force leadership or legal office, initially had said I could do all this with my photos, and then they kind of reneged and said I couldn't. And I ended up, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to fight it. I was literally within a year of retirement. I'm like, I'm not going to fight that. I'll start working back into it. Of course, you know, it lost a lot of the momentum, and part of it, a lot of my momentum on it too. I really had a drive at the time, you know, and I'm trying to get back into that, trying to work back into really, getting back in, cause I still got a lot of stuff to put up on it. You know, there's still a lot of kind of ideas. I've always been one with ideas in my head that float around, and you know, if only one out of 100 are actually accomplished, I feel pretty good. But you know, there's all things going out, you know, 20 years in the future, I want to, you know, write movies and work on movies and, you know, write a couple books and things like that. But, you know, there's ideas for this business as well. Sure. And I kind of just need to, you know, I got to get myself moving on that, motivated. This is kind of helping with it, just talking a little bit.
But, hey, that, well, yeah. You know what, that's what, yeah. TPN was all, that's, yeah. how it all started. And I think it's the Nike nailed it right away. They said, just do it. And yeah, that, I mean, you don't really need it. There's nothing else. And I think that goes for everybody, whether it's entrepreneurship, you want to go become a private pilot. You're sitting on your, resting on your laurels. I have a good friend of mine. He is a music professor. He is extremely talented, very gifted musician and conductor, composer, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
And he wants to be a private pilot. And he said to me that he's like, I think it's too late. And I go, too late? Never. It's never too late. And I said,
no.
Now he does have 4 children, and the youngest one's 3. The oldest, I think, is just about to be 13 or so. Maybe a little younger than that. Either way, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that I told him, I said, hey, you know, if it's something you really want to do, now, if you don't feel that you want to incur the insurance risk or the just the liability of going up and flying and you know, all that stuff that comes with that, the danger yeah. aspect of it all, that is understandable. But if it's something that you really want to do, you're never too old to go out and have a discovery flight at a minimum. See if you like it. Take ground school. It's, you can do it for free nowadays. You don't have to pay a thing to get to basically learn everything you can learn.
Yeah.
And that goes with everything else. And I think that rolls right into that, just do it. How did you go from now? Because this to me is the biggest question. There's a group of people who want to hear about the photography stuff. There's a group of people who want to hear just about the YouTube stuff. And I feel that's going to probably be, there's going to be a lot of people out there who want to hear that once this kind of spread. But then there's this very niche group of us that are called the Air Force guys who, and I don't understand this, and I never will understand this. You have a C-21 at Ramstein. I think you were single at that point in your life.
I was, yeah.
So you are living the true high life. You have a cost of living allowance, high BAH. You're rolling in and out of European countries at your will and leisure. And then you go from that and you say, you know what I want to do? I want to start deploying all the time, and I want to fly in a spacesuit, and I want to fly for 9 to 12 hours at a crack, with the only thing keeping me sane is at some point photography. But before then was that I've got an extra oversized pencil to do a crossword with or whatever it is, knowing some of the other YouTube guys and having that conversation.
Yeah.
How in the hell did you make that transition? What was that like? Walk us through the whole, I'm a C-21 guy today, tomorrow I'm a U2 guy. And then I got a bunch of other U2 questions that people want to know.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was, first the motivation, like one, I was coming up, I had to get out of the C-21. It was a special assignment. So mm-hmm. I was going to fly C-17s. I already had a C-17 assignment to record.
Okay.
And which I would have totally dug. I had some buddies go do it, and they loved it. We had one mission when we got to support U2s out there off of the island of Cyprus, carrying some of their film and stuff like that. And I got to talk to some of these guys, and it was, it was one thing that one guy, when I was telling him, I was like, I basically said, what was it like up there today? He's like, I saw things you couldn't believe. And, you know, I'd say, you know, that was kind of the moment I'm like, okay, I want to do this, you know, and I don't care what, you know, it cost me. It was just, it kind of gave me that bug then to start pursuing going to YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a long, complicated process, applying, interviewing. But for me being a crew guy, you know, I had done T-37 and then T-1. it, going back to single seat flying, that was a challenge initially.
Okay.
And when I came to do the interview, I remember just thinking like too much stuff is happening. Even though the U2 is not a very fast plane, like too much stuff's happening too quickly. I can't handle all this. And it's just kind of, I had to take a step back and be like, okay, this is not insurmountable. It's something, you know, I just got to kind of each time try to work on this aspect of it. Work on my, you know, my radio con, you know, the next one, work on my airspeed control and so forth. They give you a lot of chances. You end up in a 3 sortie interview. You do like almost 50 landings in the U2.
50?
50, yeah.
Wow.
It's close to that. And they're brutal flights because you're just doing this over and over again. And you know, it's not an easy plane to fly. I had almost even more of a challenge once I was accepted and I came and I started flying the T-38. You know, that was another thing. It was like, it was just, things happen very quickly. And that, you know, it's because it's your basic, you know, pattern speed is 300 knots. So, you know, you're flying around on setting up for an instrument approach and you're literally going to be on final, like within a minute of, you know, you setting up for the approach. So, mm-hmm. It just took a lot of, you know, kind of, I had to be better at pre-planning what I was going to do. I couldn't get out there and just make it happen at the time. I had to know, like, you know, when I was, you know, set up on the T-38, now I'm going to fly like several approaches. I'm going to already have those approaches like out, they're sitting under my leg, you know, and strapped on here. And like, I know I can easily reach for them because, you know, God forbid if I had to sit there and flip one of those approach books, flying a T-38, I'm going to be upside down within a half a second, you know, I'm like, crap. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a challenge in that regard, just, you know, but it just kind of led, you know, I had to do that self-discipline to kind of sit there and pre-plan out really, you know, I would say they talk about chair flying, like,
sure.
You know, from the beginning of pilot training and stuff, I was never really good at that or never, I guess most of the stuff in pilot training seemed fairly easy to me and stuff, but this is where it really took me to kind of sit down, like really thinking through every step. As I was making that transition to, you know, the T-38 and then the U-2, because, you know, they start you out on that, basically, even though you're in two-seaters, they're basically treating you like you're a single pilot. They're not going to
treat
for you. Even though it's a lot slower plane, it's a much more precise plane. You have to be very precise on your speeds and you know, glide path and everything.
Yeah.
To land that aircraft. So it was kind of a process, but I had to be very deliberate about getting into it.
So we could probably talk for 45 minutes just on the training aspect of what training in the U2 is. And I have a couple of friends that I've talked to about it, who I won't mention their name. I'll talk to you afterwards and you'll laugh because I got a really funny story about that, but I'm not going to embarrass him here, even though he does deserve it.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, he totally does. One of the pieces of this puzzle, I think that's really interesting. And I've seen it, cause I've been lucky enough to be based at a place where they had, for deployment where the deuce is the guys called it, I believed.
Yeah.
And I got to see all the process of suit up and all that stuff. So why don't take me through what a flight looks like from you see Ross sees himself on the schedule for next week, Wednesday, and it's Friday afternoon and he's going home to have a weekend with the kiddos and futz around at the house. And now it's Monday morning. No, he's going to be flying on Wednesday evening to catch those Northern Lights. What does that lead up look like?
Probably the biggest thing leading up to it is, at least for you two guys, planning out your meals. You know, probably second to that, planning out your rest and how you're going to be rested for it. But sitting in a spacesuit for, you know, in my case, I ended up having a lot of spacesuit problems when I went in. It took them over 2 hours to get me integrated into the suit. before I even took off, and then another hour. So I ended up being in the spacesuit for about 15 hours. So if I think about, you know, I'm going to be locked into this thing for the foreseeable future, basically, you have to plan out that you're not going to suddenly have to go, you know, go take a crap right in the middle of that. So the so the first thing that, you know, a YouTube pilot's thinking about is like what their meal looks like leading up to it. And you very quickly learn what your body does when you you learn how regular you are, learn how what your style is, what motivates you, I would say, or motivates your body.
Motivates your body?
So and there's literally a spectrum. You know, some guys could literally be like, they would go in and eat like a chili dog eating contest the night before and try to eat, 100 chili dogs, and then they go fly 12 hours and they're fine. Other people are literally starving themselves for like 24 hours and then drinking a bottle of Pepto-Bismol before they go fly.
Oh, God, that sounds awful.
That's true. That's a true story too. I was not that. Yeah. I realized that I was somewhere in between. If I watched what I ate, leading up to the flight, within, 12, 24 hours of the flight, I'm eating something like, some chicken, maybe some eggs for breakfast or whatever, but they say, high protein, low residue tech foods. So, whatever any YouTube pilot tells you, that is what they are thinking about before they're getting in the suit.
Sure.
Am I good to go for the next 12 hours?
Yeah. And legitimate, not, so most tanker guys, not all of them, but a lot of tanker guys will pride themselves on have never using the facilities. Yeah. That's why maybe there's quite a few tanker guys who end up becoming really a long time pilots. I don't know if it's a good mashup, but it's funny because, what you tell tour groups and the kids is a lot different than what you tell fellow pilots, because that's for a lot of us, that's one of the biggest curiosities. Like, it's one thing for an F-16 guy who, even on a combat sortie, maybe is airborne for 5.5-6 hours. Yeah, that sucks. But they're also, brains are going a lot. They're locked in on something happening all the time.
Yeah.
I know, and I'm sure that you can attest to this, and please, that talking to the YouTube guys out there that I've met, talked to, that's not necessarily the case. There's a lot of lull. There's some lulls in that flight.
Yeah, there's depending on the missions. There were some 10 or 12 hour missions that seemed to go by in a few hours because they were very interesting. We're very engaged with what's going on the ground and stuff like that. And then there's some 8 hour missions that I thought were like 16 hours.
It'll never end.
Yeah, like this is so boring. Really just being like physiologically ready for the flight, it's probably one of the biggest lead ups to it. Usually, as far as like mission prep and stuff, when we're deployed, you do quite a bit of mission study before you even deploy, before you even go. And then it's kind of, you're just staying on top of what's going on day to day. And you get on kind of a routine. You're deployed, flying every 4 days or something like that. And, the missions, they're never really routine, because really routine operations in the U2 are still not routine, but it's about as routine as you can get in a lot of cases, you're still doing all the same pilot stuff, and that includes the day of the flight. We're checking NOTAM and stuff like that. So
sure.
Even though we're going to be flying above most of the weather, and above most of the airspace, we still have to climb and descend through all that stuff. So, I've gone through some nasty thunderstorm stuff, coming down. I've seen some nasty thunderstorms from 25,000 feet above them and look down at them and be like, man, that would suck to be flying through that. and it's kind of cool when you look down and you can see the contrails, just like when you look up at some guy at 35,000 feet when you're on the ground, you can look down at a guy at 35,000 feet from 35,000 feet higher, and it looks the same way. You see this little big plane, little contrail, gliding by.
Wow, that down below. Never thought about that. Yeah.
And it's pretty wild.
I don't know. Are you sure those weren't chemtrails? Or are those first? Or were they contrails or chemtrails? Are
we? I thought we signed an NDA on that. We can't.
Discuss, oh shoot! But, you know, sorry. Yeah. Well, I'll edit that part out. That's edited.
Definitely.
Out. Yeah, because as a tanker guy, you know, I definitely can't talk about.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had extra tanks to be able to carry all that stuff, you know.
Yeah, well, so, somebody has to, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking
yeah.
of, if for all my friends that live in the Michigan Detroit area, there is an awesome billboard on the way up to from the airport to the Brighton area that talks about the chemtrails, and I think there's a really great website for those of you who want to go check it out.
Nice.
It is hilarious. I will actually give that a plug because I think it's funny.
So
talking about that process of lead up, and I think I know that this part interested me when I watched it, was getting into the suit itself and like that piece of it. Because I know you've already done your mission plan because you're not going to prep once you're in the suit. It's they get you in the suit and then they get you out to the plane and walk you out there. So how long does that take and what does that look like from the time that you show up at Life Support, AFE, whatever they're called now for that, because I think they're definitely more, there's a lot more interactivity than with like a tanker day.
Yeah, our guys, they're called PSPTS, Physiological Training Squadron. Those are the guys at Beale who, some of them are physiologists, some are AFE techs. They all come there and they do they do the job of space suit technician, and they literally take care of all the, you know, everything from our seat kits with the survival gear, our parachutes. They're the ones that load all those in the jet. They maintain our suits, and they're the ones that actually get us in the suit, do all the checks on our suit, take us out, and actually put us in the jet. But before we go over there, we split from, you know, we have they call them the chase car pilot. A lot of guys have seen that. If you have a Google, you know, YouTube, some chase car videos of YouTube. And so that's just another U2 guy. So he's like your wingman. He's the guy that we look at the weather and notice all that stuff with. And when we split to go to the, put the suit on, he's the guy going to the jet. Mm-hmm. He's the one doing the walk around. He does all the pre-flight on it. He's also that backup pilot. So if you're going to come in and be the mobile, as they call it, the chase car guy, you got to be ready to show up and be the other guy to be like, hey, my bowels are not going to let me go flying today. Can you go fly? So I've had that happen on both ends where you're the guy that suddenly you're getting in the spacesuit instead of you thought you were just going to be driving the car and drinking coffee in the building that day and mission monitoring while they're on a mission. And suddenly you're the guy getting in the suit. But the, you know, so you've split, now you're going to get in the suit. They used to do like a little mini physical on us. They don't really do that anymore, but they used to just basically be blood pressure, stuff like that. They'd ask us what our last two meals are, and what times we had those, when we went to sleep and when we woke up. Everything would come off, and then the first thing that would go on would be the urinary collection device.
I've seen it.
Yeah. You've seen it, yeah.
As a non-U2 guy, I've seen it.
Yeah, well, and if you've ever been in the building with a guy coming out with it, like you of course you've seen it because you can't take your eyes off of it. It's like it's just a natural human instinct. You see, you know, someone with a big swinging thing between their legs. That it doesn't matter who you are, you're gonna stare and be like, "What is that?" Yeah. So this thing, you put that on, put on your cotton underwear over that, basically just long johns. They're going to go out there. They're going to start putting the suit on you. And it takes two technicians to basically help you get into the suit. That UCD on the inside of this, on the leg, before you put the rest of the suit on, you basically put your legs in and you clip that in, to a little tube on the inside of the suit. And that tube is connected to a valve on the outside of the suit and another tube going out. And that's what, when in flight, you're able to open up that valve, creates a suction, and you're able to just go, it goes out into a little flexion tank. But if you miss that step somehow, or you somehow screw up that step, where the UCD doesn't click right, or it comes disconnected then afterwards, then there's no way to fix it, and you're just peeing on yourself. So fun fact, that flight where I did the Northern Lights, all those shots and those selfies and everything like that, I'm covered in pee. So, to reduce the cool factor a little bit. Yeah. So, Northern Lights and spacesuit, and I've got pee all over me because something happened, somewhere. I don't know when, but yeah. And it's always the most demoralizing thing. And it's only happened to me a couple times in my whole career. That you go to do that first pee, you know, you're up, it's been an hour or whatever, and you open up the valve and you're like, well, okay, I don't really feel much suction, but I'm going to go. Sometimes it's a little kinked or whatever. You're waiting to see some of that flowing out of the suit, and then you don't see anything flowing, and then suddenly you feel it all spreading around you. And of course, starts warm, turns cold because of the bent air. Now you're sitting in wet, cold pee for the rest of the flight. And there's nothing you're going to do about it. So, so that's a little fun fact on that.
Awesome.
Very, very important step, though. Make sure that connection is good before you put the rest of this. big effect on your life.
Yeah, that's a quality of life thing right there.
Exactly, yeah.